This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
So, very unusual storm. In fact, there's a study that's just been released saying that this was probably a 1 in 8,000 year storm for Jamaica, but climate change has made it four times more likely, so it's more like a 1 in 1,700 year storm. It reached the lowest pressure we've ever seen for a landfalling hurricane, 892 millibars, and the highest winds we've ever seen for a landfalling Atlantic hurricane, 185 mile per hour winds.
To be alive at the time when I witnessed the strongest hurricane on record to hit land anywhere in the Atlantic basin, well, that's historic.
In a world of storms, there is before and after Melissa. Jamaica, insurance, hard times, and lucky breaks this week on Radio EcoShock. Hurricane Melissa with famous meteorologist John Morales in Miami and hurricane blogger Dr. Jeff Masters. I'm Alex Smith. Let's go.
Melissa, she take you home. Melissa, she take your life. You don't want to meet Melissa before.
Often seen on major television networks, John Tui Morales is a professional meteorologist and founder of private forecasting company Climadata. John is the hurricane specialist for WTVJ, NBC in Miami, and a famous voice during the big ones. From Miami, John Morales, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Were you surprised at how quickly a tropical disturbance in the Caribbean spun into one of the largest hurricanes ever seen in the Atlantic?
Well, I tell you, I mean, these days, nothing surprises me, right? We're seeing systems that are pretty mundane quickly ramp up, going through either rapid or extremely rapid intensification cycles to end up as these very catastrophic hurricanes. So I think what continues to surprise me is how often this is happening. And that's really what kind of astounds me and leads me to all these different reactions, which I guess I'm starting to get known for, because I've been in the profession too long, you know, 41 years as a meteorologist, and the changes are palpable and impossible to ignore, and that's what has me surprised.
It can catch people really off guard if there's a bit of disturbance somewhere, and then within a day, that's a cat-something storm. It's hard to prepare for that, and you don't want to give off false alarms either.
Right. I mean, I try to tell the anecdote. Keep in mind, you know, my work as a broadcast meteorologist has been in the Miami television market. So the story I like to tell people is that one of these days, there's going to be a tropical storm in the central Bahamas, you know, I don't know, maybe the Exumas, which 36 hours later is going to make landfall in Miami as a Category 4 hurricane. And it's exactly what you're saying. It's the element of people being so surprised by such rapid intensification that they might have ignored it or poo-pooed the threat, and then find themselves in a real bind when you end up with a hurricane of that intensity making landfall.
We often hear a pressure reading for each storm in millibars. How should the public interpret those numbers? Like, what is normal and what is almost record serious?
I think most people, at least Americans anyway, you know, like the imperial system, inches of mercury, I guess, but millibars is just another way of measuring barometric pressure. The normal, the standard barometric pressure is 1,000, but add a little bit, 1,013 to be precise, okay? But it's okay if people think about it, you know, as close to 1,000. Listen, by the time you get to 970, 960, you're already in hurricane territory. But then when you get below 900, right, that's record-setting stuff. That's top five hurricane of all time stuff. And that's what Melissa did, right? I mean, Melissa, by pressure, is the third strongest hurricane ever recorded in the Atlantic Basin, and also by pressure and by wind speed, the strongest hurricane to ever make landfall in the Atlantic, top number one.
That is amazing. It is still early to estimate rainfall totals dropping on Jamaica, but maybe it was less than feared because the storm picked up speed? Your thoughts, John?
I can tell you that Jamaica probably ends up getting less rain than Haiti and the Dominican Republic, because while this storm was in its formative stages, it sat south of Hispaniola for a long, long time, throwing moisture in their direction. And we saw the hurricane make landfall on a Tuesday, right? It had formed a week prior, and that's when it started to rain in Hispaniola. And even before it became a hurricane, over 20 inches of rain had accumulated in Hispaniola. This is 600 millimeters of rain. Okay, that's a lot of rain. So I think Jamaica at that time was on the dry side, on the less active side during that time span when it was sitting south of Hispaniola. I have a feeling that they didn't get, you know, 30 inches. They probably are in the 15 to 20 inch range.
Melissa appeared pretty late in the 2025 season. We know wildfire seasons are now longer. What about hurricane seasons?
Yeah, hurricane seasons are changing in many ways. First off, in recent years, we've seen these backloaded hurricane seasons where it's not until after September 10th, which is historically the peak date of hurricane season, that we end up seeing most of the storms and the strongest hurricanes. Now, we've also seen, for example, in recent years, about half the time, if not more, May storms, tropical storms that form in May. And while it hasn't quite extended all the way to December, I mean, storms can form just about any month of the year with the possible exception of January, in the heart of winter, right? The bottom line here is that sea surface temperatures are warmer earlier and later in the year. So as far as the time scale of hurricane season, you could say that there are greater chances for us to see stronger activity earlier and stronger activity later. Plus, geographically, it's expanding as well because, again, sea surface temperatures are warm in places where they didn't used to be warm. So you'll have this year we had the development, I believe, of subtropical storm Karen, furthest north, I believe, development of a system. It just gives you an understanding here that, you know, it didn't used to be so warm in those places, and that's now supporting the formation of these storms.
Very few people in Jamaica had insurance. Can people still buy hurricane and flood insurance in Florida?
Well, you can still buy insurance in Florida, but it's very costly. And often you end up in the hands of companies that are very new. You know, they've been spun up recently to try to take on these opportunities of insurance carriers, because we have an insurer of last resort that is partly government run here in the state of Florida. It's called Citizens Insurance, property insurance company. But Citizens won't take everybody. First, you have to prove that your option for insurance is too costly or unattainable, and then the government entity jumps in. Flood insurance, the same deal. Keep in mind, the National Flood Insurance Program is essentially bankrupt. FEMA and their flood zones have modified their flood zones, and this impacts the NFIP, the National Flood Insurance Program, to where more appropriate pricing, right, is being listed for these flood insurance policies. but that more appropriate pricing is unaffordable for many. So you're seeing folks that might still owe on their property because, you know, if they own it outright, they can go without insurance and fend for themselves. But if they owe on the property, they find themselves in a bind where they can't afford the insurance combined with a payment for the house, and they end up having to sell that property and to somebody richer that might be able to afford it.
Ocean conditions were favorable for storms this summer, and the Gulf of Mexico was unusually hot, well above normal, but no major hurricane reached the mainland. Are experts learning what triggers years with multiple named storms versus quiet years?
Oh, yeah, but I mean, there's so many reasons for that. And frankly, you can have a very active year and still not have the steering currents set up in such a way to allow for the hurricanes to reach the U.S. mainland. So I think this year is a good example of that. I mean, we've had, category 4 or greater hurricanes. 3 of those became category 5 hurricanes. The season, by the way, is already by that count, not just by the count of major hurricanes and extreme hurricanes, but by the count of accumulated cyclone energy, which takes into account the longevity of the storm, the intensity of the storm. By that count, we're also above normal this hurricane season, just as predicted. But Americans think that nothing happened. and watch the news cycle move on from Jamaica, and Americans will quickly forget about this hurricane season because it did not impact the mainland. The steering currents were not right. We had many strong hurricanes, all of them potentially catastrophic, much like the one that hit Jamaica did. But we had a big dip in the jet stream along the eastern seaboard, which tended to deflect the storms off to the north, have them recurve far out at sea and not strike the U.S. And in the case of the Western Caribbean and the Gulf of Mexico, you know, nothing forming there at the time of the year where it could be steered towards the U.S. So I think the U.S. lucked out.
It comes down to luck.
It often does, yes.
All right. Now, according to news reports, the administration cut hurricane monitoring in half. Are you confident that private companies like yours can provide predictions that governments and the public need?
Well, the model, the business model of the American Weather Enterprise doesn't work like that. Our private companies can't do the work without the scaffolding that NOAA and the National Weather Service provides. So this is not like the business model elsewhere or in just about all other countries that I know of, where there are fees for data and fees for services from the National Meteorological and Hydrological Services of all these different countries, right? In the U.S., the taxpayers fund NOAA and the National Weather Service. That data is utilized and leveraged by private companies to provide value-added services, which the government alone cannot provide. So, for example, my company, we don't do this anymore simply because those clients have moved on or whatnot. We used to provide very specific forecasts for multinational pharmaceutical companies doing business in Puerto Rico. Right. Johnson's and Johnson's, Baxter Pharmaceuticals and others. Why? Because they had 24-hour operations that were very sensitive to weather conditions, and they were concerned about their employees, when they could go home, when could they return, what shifts were safe to open, when did they have to shut down their chemical processes. You know, you can't be asking the National Weather Service, the government weather service, to be providing that level of detail to each and every interested entity out there to do that. So the value-added services provided by companies like ours with the data provided by NOAA enhances the economy and helps these pharmaceuticals and multinationals be able to produce their medications and drugs and whatnot, which are a benefit to society. So, in the U.S., without at least in her current business model, without the help of NOAA, private companies, and this includes the biggest ones. You know, think of the AccuWeathers of the world, or the Weather Company, which is owned by IBM, which used to own the Weather Channel, right? You know, these are some of the biggest weather companies in the world, and I'm telling you, without NOAA, we're nothing. So we need that entity, that government agency, to continue to be strong.
And your website at climadata.com offers forensic meteorology. What is that, John?
Sure. Forensic meteorology is the reconstruction of past weather events. So you're almost like a detective. You are accessing or mining for data to be analyzed by a meteorologist, for accuracy and calibration, and then combining that with the weather maps, or maybe reconstructions through weather models of past weather events, all in the process oftentimes of aiding in litigation where weather has been a factor. So forensic meteorologists are often working with attorneys, again, in litigation. They could be working for plaintiff or for defendant. It depends. And that's not to say that that's the exclusive realm of a forensic meteorologist. You could potentially see a forensic meteorologist working in an aircraft accident investigation, or a traffic investigation, or a marine incident, right? It doesn't have to be in litigation, but that's what forensic meteorologists do.
As we wrap up here, do you think that Hurricane Melissa is something that experts like yourself will remember for a time? And if so, why? Is this a real record setter?
Yeah, I'm certainly going to remember Melissa for probably the rest of my career. And that's because to be alive at the time when I witnessed the strongest hurricane on record to hit land anywhere in the Atlantic basin, well, that's historic. And that's by two measures. It's by barometric pressure at 892 millibars, and it's by maximum sustained wind speed of 185 mile per hour. There have been hurricanes with stronger wind speeds. Hurricane Allen comes to mind in 1980, wind speed of 190 miles per hour. But Allen did not make landfall when it was at 190 miles per hour, right? There have been stronger hurricanes by pressure. Hurricane Gilbert in 1988 and Hurricane Wilma in 2005. But both of those pressure records of 888 and 882, respectively, were not set as the hurricanes were making landfall. And the pressure by the time they made landfall was nowhere near what it was for Melissa. So, Melissa's name will be retired from the list of available names for future tropical cyclones in the Atlantic. We will not see another Melissa. That name will be retired.
From Miami, we've been talking with TV personality and professional hurricane forecaster John Tule Morales. And John, thank you for spending time with our radio listeners.
Well, I was glad to be here, and thanks for the excellent questions.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Who tracks every big storm? One of the original NOAA hurricane hunters, meteorologist Dr. Jeff Masters. Jeff co-founded the Weather Underground and now contributes to Yale Climate Connections. Jeff Masters, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex.
Well, meteorologists couldn't hide some amazement at Hurricane Melissa. What stood out to you from the start, Jeff?
First of all, this was October 28th, which is 7 weeks past the usual peak of the hurricane season. We typically only see about 10% of the activity of a season after October 28th, so this occurred very late in the year. And part of the reason that this was able to occur was because the Caribbean has not seen any other activity this year. So the waters were toasty warm. No other hurricanes had crossed over and stirred the waters up.
Right. We forget the hurricanes actually cool the ocean behind them, and that just didn't happen this year.
No, the steering currents have been very friendly to land areas. We've only had one other land-falling storm this year. That was back in June, a minimal strength tropical storm Chantel that hit South Carolina.
Well, tell us about some of the records set or approached by Melissa.
It reached to the lowest pressure we've ever seen for a land-falling hurricane, 892 millibars, and the highest winds we've ever seen for a land-falling Atlantic hurricane, 185 mile-per-hour winds. That's actually tied with the 1935 hurricane in the Florida Keys. And if you want to talk about stronger Atlantic hurricanes that didn't hit land, there's only ever been one. That was Hurricane Allen back in 1980. It had 190 mile-per-hour winds, only 5 mile-per-hour faster than Melissa. Those are the main records that stand out, just the absolutely mind-boggling intensity of this hurricane and the fact that it was able to hit land at that intensity. No Caribbean island has ever seen a landfall like that, and certainly Jamaica had never seen anything like that. Their strongest previous hurricane was back in 1988, a Cat 4 called Gilbert that hit the island and caused about $2.7 billion in damage.
So are we looking at something that humans really haven't seen before, at least in the time of measurements?
In the Atlantic, we've seen one other storm for sure this strong. That was back in 1935. In the Western Pacific, there have been a number of storms this strong, maybe 10 or 15 or so. But you get a lot more intense storms out there because it's such a bigger ocean. Storms don't run into land so often, and you got a bigger pool of warm water for them to feed off of. So very unusual storm. In fact, there's a study that's just been released saying that this was probably a 1 in 8,000 year storm for Jamaica, but climate change has made it four times more likely, so it's more like a 1 in 1,700 year storm. Still very rare, but we're going to be seeing a lot more of these with climate change.
Would you send me a link to that study? I'll put it in my blog for listeners.
I can do that.
Okay. Now, early predictions suggested Melissa would hover over Jamaica for a day or two, increasing extreme rainfall dangers, but then the hurricane moved on to Cuba the very next day. Did it speed up in its rate of travel?
What happened is that we expected it to stall just south of Jamaica, close enough to drench it with heavy rains, but that stall happened about 50 miles further south than we thought it would. And that 50 miles made all the difference because the heavy rain stayed just offshore, and the only heavy rains that the island got were for about a day period instead of the 2 or 3 day period that was initially feared. So it behaved very close to expectations. 50 miles isn't a lot of difference when you're talking about weak steering currents and the modeling we try to do for these type of storms. So we did get a little bit lucky with Melissa, but certainly Western Jamaica won't think they got lucky at all.
Well, Jeff, you've flown into the eye of giant hurricanes as part of the NOAA Hurricane Hunters. This time, those big prop planes turned away twice, citing safety. What does that tell you?
It was an exceptionally turbulent storm. And flying into high-end Category 5 hurricanes really pushes the limit of safety when you think about putting an aircraft in there. And I'm very concerned for the future of the Hurricane Hunters. We're going to be seeing a lot more Melissas in the future, and it's just not safe to fly a crewed aircraft in there. We need to put drones in there. I mean, drone technology is coming. It's not quite here yet. So extreme turbulence, 3 gravities of acceleration, that's what made those planes turn around, and that's not safe.
Well, they had to find volunteers for the planes this year. Is it safe to cut so many hurricane staff from the federal government?
You're pushing your luck when you start cutting hurricane research and hurricane operational type of activity. I mean, we know that the last 20 years of hurricane research advancements that we've done have led to about a $5 billion savings per storm that hits the U.S. And we really shouldn't jeopardize that type of research going forward. It's only going to get better. Our models are getting better all the time. That investment really pays off. The entire budget of NOAA is only about $6 billion. So saving $5 billion per storm from just a relatively minor investment of a few hundred million dollars over the last 20 years is money well spent. So I am really railing against the cuts that are going on to NOAA. This goes way beyond the stated goal of trying to stop climate alarmism. We really are cutting into our capability to make weather forecasts that protect lives and property and it's a really dumb thing to be doing.
This storm season in the Atlantic seemed strange. All the conditions for major hurricanes were there, and yet no smasher made it as far as North America. Then this late season, here comes Melissa. How do you read this hurricane season?
We were due for a season where we don't get a major hurricane making landfall in the continental U.S. We'd gone 5 straight years with major hurricanes making landfalls, and we underwent a period from 2006 to 2015 where we didn't see any major hurricanes make landfall. So we were due for a quiet period. I mean, hurricanes are like bananas. They come in bunches, one famous meteorologist once said. And maybe we'll get a few years in a row here without a major hurricane landfall in the U.S. We certainly could use one with all the cuts going on to FEMA.
Yes, you found a 2021 paper, Poverty and Hurricane Risk Exposure in Jamaica. What does that tell us about Melissa's path through that country?
Melissa picked the worst part of the country to move over with respect to the quality of the building stock. A steel-reinforced concrete building can withstand a Cat 5, but a lesser structure is going to be destroyed. And we're going to see near-total destruction over a 20-mile-wide swath of Jamaica. It's going to look like an EF3 or an EF4 tornado went across there. So very unfortunate, but that's not the heavily populated part of the country, so Jamaica's fortunate that it didn't hit Kingston, where they do have better building codes, but it's very heavily populated, and the damage would have been so much more.
Well, you mentioned Cat 5. Just last year, we talked about proposals to add a new Cat 6 designation for more powerful storms showing up in recent years. What do you think now, and would Hurricane Melissa make the cut?
The most recent paper that came out advocating a Cat 6 scale put the limit there at sustained winds of 193 mile per hour, which Melissa fell just short of. So it would not be a Cat 6 by that scale. I've proposed that we should have a lesser criteria for a Cat 6, more like 185, which Melissa was. So from a awareness of what climate change is doing to these storms goes, we should have a Cat 6. But from a practical warning point of view, I don't think it does make sense. You're going to evacuate for a Cat 5 because it's catastrophic. Cat 6 is mega catastrophic. You should evacuate for both, but you're not going to be motivated to evacuate any more so than if it were just a Cat 5 coming at you.
Going from hard science to conjecture, Jeff, do you think big storms later in this century will be like Melissa more of the time, or could hurricanes and typhoons get even stranger?
We don't know what to expect in a lot of senses. One of the big surprises with Melissa is that it lasted as a Cat 5 so long, 36 straight hours as a Cat 5. That's very unusual. Typically, hurricanes see fluctuations in their intensity when they get so strong. We call them eyewall replacement cycles, where the inner eyewall collapses. It's replaced by a larger diameter eyewall from an outer spiral band, and then it shrinks again and becomes the inner eyewall. Melissa didn't do any of that, and we don't know why. So that's a surprise that maybe we'll see more of in the future. I don't know. So the future is a little murky. When you start pushing the boundaries of what is possible with the atmosphere, extreme events can surprise you. So I'm not really sure what the future holds.
I see most of your work published at Yale Climate Connections. Are you working on anything big, or does each season keep you as busy as you want to be?
This is going to be my last season that I plan on doing regular updates of hurricanes, the day by day. You know, this is what this disturbance in the Caribbean is likely to do. I mean, I may step in and talk about big storms like Melissa when they happen, but we're witnessing the end of an era. After 21 years, I'm hanging it up. I'm not going to be doing the regular blog anymore with Bob Henson. So no big plans. I'm enjoying doing less, being retired, and doing enjoyment of family and life and travel. And I will continue to talk about extreme weather and climate change on my blog. That's not going to go away. But not so much the day-to-day, here's what's going on with the weather.
Well, we may just have to make a map of your brain before you leave.
may be able to get somebody to come in and take over my blog. It's undetermined at this point.
Okay. From Michigan, we've been speaking with meteorologist Dr. Jeff Masters. You can find links to Jeff and his work in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. And, of course, go to Yale Climate Connections. Jeff, thank you for volunteering your time to keep us all informed.
Sure, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Melissa.
Speaking of drowning storms, the Environment Ministry of Vietnam announced a new national record for rainfall in 24 hours. More than a meter, about 5.5 feet of rain, fell on the central Vietnamese city of Hue. The whole central coastal region was inundated. Thousands were evacuated. Schools closed. This is extreme rain without the typhoon. It's just another story that doesn't get told. Let's quickly review just a couple of key points from the interviews with Morales and Masters. Both of them raise surprising and unexpected turns to this story. That adds a new dimension about what to expect.
Not much warning.
As you heard from Morales, a well-known weather voice in Miami, a tropical depression in the Caribbean can appear in Miami and only 36 hours later. That barely leaves time for news and human reaction. Sometimes the possible does not arrive as we predicted, and we begin to discount the threat, and that makes the real thing even harder when it comes. After Melissa, communities in the Gulf, up the East Coast, around the world need to run hurricane drills. First responders, media, local governments, communities, police, what will you do? You need to know well in advance. How will evacuations work? Shelters? All of that. You can call for storm drills in your own community. Governments can follow Jamaica's lead and prepare disaster funding years ahead. Getting disaster aid and rebuilding funds into a devastated city or region, it's kind of like saving a person with a heart attack. The sooner help arrives and renewal begins, the better it goes. Recovery can be planned, at least for some countries.
Storm insurance.
You heard John Morales explain troubles in the Florida insurance industry. After repeated billion-dollar disasters there from hurricanes, some insurance companies stopped writing new policies or left the state. There is a government-backed fund of last resort, but it isn't easy to get. Underreported in the news, there's a real crisis in Florida, where monthly insurance rates can be as high as mortgage payments. You can't get a bank mortgage without storm insurance. Regular working people are being squeezed out of the housing market by this double whammy. Climate change, pushing stronger hurricanes, is a huge factor, whether the governor of Florida believes it or not.
Radio EcoShock.
As I said to John, very few Jamaicans had storm insurance on their homes. Back in July of this very year, IAJ, the Insurance Association of Jamaica, warned only about 20% of properties in the country carry insurance. Of that 20%, the IAJ estimates 95% are underinsured. Homes and businesses may have lowballed the value of properties to save on premiums, or the insured value from 10 years ago is not anywhere near the real replacement cost now. That leaves at least 80% of Jamaican properties with no insurance, just massive losses for individuals or small business. The economic ripple could last for years, not days. Find a link to that July article in the Jamaica Gleaner in my show blog at ecoshock.org. However, Jamaica as a country was better prepared for a big hurricane than her neighbors, especially Haiti. Even in the poorer western side of Jamaica, where Melissa hit, infrastructure and government were functional before the storm arrived. It turns out Jamaica really planned ahead. The government of Jamaica bought its own insurance policy called a catastrophe bond. CBC, the Canadian Public Broadcasting Company, reports, quote, "Last year, the country issued $150 million U.S. in a catastrophe or cat bond, triggered in case of certain parameters related to how strong a hurricane is and where it passes through. They are linked to the central pressure of the hurricane when it makes landfall," said Florian Steiger, CEO of Icosa Investments, a Swiss firm that focuses on catastrophe bonds. "A third party needs to verify the trigger, but that's no question in this case that the necessary threshold has been crossed. Funds could get to Jamaica in a matter of days. Jamaica's strategy is, in my perspective, one of the most comprehensive of any country globally at the minute," said Connor Meenan, a risk financing advisor at the UK-based Centre for Disaster Protection. "The country also has multiple eggs in its disaster risk basket, including insurance policies to cover extreme rainfall and tropical storms, through a regional pool that provides disaster insurance to Caribbean countries. Additionally, it can draw on lines of credit with the World Bank and the Inter-American Development Bank." In total, Jamaica's finance ministry says it has about $820 million U.S. available in financing to draw from in the days and weeks right after a disaster. That won't cover all of the likely billions of dollars in damages needed, but the insurance-related financing will flow to Jamaica much faster and help quickly restore the most essential services like roads, healthcare, and telecommunications. That's an end quote from CBC News, October 30th, 2025, link in my blog.
Haiti flooding.
Unlike Jamaica, Haiti barely has a functional government. Most of the capital is controlled by armed criminal gangs. Melissa hit Haiti hard. Far more people died in Haiti during the storm than in Jamaica, which took the direct hit. John Morales explained why. A week before Melissa was named as a hurricane, this extra-large tropical storm was hanging around in the Caribbean. Day after day, it gathered water from the sea. The outer bands of the storm dropped more than a foot of rain on Haiti and the Dominican Republic, and not so much on Jamaica during that formative week. A further factor, most of Haiti has been deforested and land degraded. Landslides are too common. Nobody invested in flood control. In Haiti, 25 people died during Melissa. It was much less in Jamaica. Haiti tears through those official statements that everybody needs to prepare for extreme weather now that we've changed the climate. Many countries cannot prepare, cannot protect themselves, and may never fully recover from the next disaster. On the other hand, some countries surprise us. Bangladesh is one of the poorer countries in the world. They routinely lost thousands of people to cyclones roaring up the Bay of Bengal. We covered that on Radio EcoShock, how government and communities in Bangladesh greatly improved storm survival. They built hurricane bunkers on low-lying deltas, worked out mass emergency plans, made it work, and saved many lives. Who expected Jamaica to be a world leader in financial planning for storm recovery? Who expected the United States to dismantle their own agencies for recovery? As always, it's a human problem as well as climate physics.
Can it stand?
One small thing in our interview, Jeff Masters says steel-reinforced concrete buildings can survive a Cat 5 hurricane. That is technically true. The walls remain standing, but the interior, the cladding, the roof may be blown away, rendering the building a total loss. It may be cheaper to tear it down than build new. Perhaps no one has the money to repair anyway. All this happened when Hurricane Otis struck Acapulco, Mexico in 2023. About 80% of hotels, mostly standing along the coastal strip, they were damaged. As of spring 2024, many hotels and condo buildings were still described as abandoned with missing facades, and the skyline still bore visible scars. They looked sort of skeletal. About half of the previous hotel rooms damaged by Otis have reopened for business. repairs on other buildings are going slowly and may not reach previous levels for another couple of years, if ever. Technically, steel-framed concrete buildings, especially those engineered for hurricane zones, are rated to withstand winds up to about 180 miles an hour, sometimes higher, approaching or meeting Cat 5 criteria, which is 157 miles per hour. Melissa was far above that, reaching 185 miles per hour, sustained wind speeds when it struck the coast. Future storms could be even stronger. As hotter oceans drive superstorms, even concrete steel buildings may face threats greater than their structural design. Even now, everything but the concrete can be wrecked, as we saw in Acapulco. Getting into official and cop side of business, Antonio Guterres, the Secretary General of the United Nations, now says the 1.5 degrees C warming target set in Paris is no longer possible. We can stop pretending now.
The truth is that we have failed to avoid an overshooting above 1.5 degrees in the next few years. Countries are presenting their national determined contributions. From those received until now, there is an expectation of a reduction of emissions of 10%. We would need 60%. So overshooting is now inevitable. And so it is absolutely indispensable to change course in order to make sure that that overshooting is as small as possible. And this is a basic condition to avoid tipping points. We don't want to see the Amazon as a savanna. But that is a real risk if we don't change course and if we don't take a dramatic decrease of emissions as soon as possible.
Many of my expert guests suggest this planet will warm 2 degrees C over pre-industrial in the next few decades. Most of the new added heat goes into the seas. Warmer oceans speed melting glaciers, change ecology, threaten some species. Warmer oceans can turn into more deadly marine heat waves. And as we heard today, warming oceans are guaranteed to power more intense storms. We are already in a time of repeating disasters. Normal life, whatever that means, becomes a break between disasters. The time between hurricanes or wildfires or running out of water becomes shorter with each added year of polluting the atmosphere.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. ecoshock.org.
Let's listen to my conversation with the leading American hurricane expert, MIT's Kerry Emanuel. Kerry followed storm lore for decades, even writing a history of tropical storm knowledge called The Divine Wind. This clip is from Radio EcoShock, February 16, 2022.
A best of Radio EcoShock replay.
If there is a hurricane man in science, that may be Dr. Kerry Emanuel. For decades, Dr. Emanuel published highly cited benchmark papers on tropical cyclones, as they are known in the field. His book, Divine Wind, The History and Science of Hurricanes, is right here on my shelf. Dr. Emanuel is now Professor Emeritus of Atmospheric Sciences at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. From Massachusetts, Kerry Emanuel, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
People are understandably nervous about hurricanes or typhoons. They are just awesome things. You worked on the upper limits to hurricanes for decades. Could novel storms develop bigger than anything recorded so far?
Oh, yes, they should be able to do that. We're lifting the cap on how strong hurricanes can be. And if you look at the hurricanes in the record books today, most of them have occurred since 2000. And some of them more recently than that. So we are beginning to see this, maybe not so far in a statistically completely satisfying way, but I would put my money on us breaking records for storm intensity going into the future.
I talked with Michael Weiner for the show, and he wondered whether superstorms above Cat 5 wind speeds would be able to maintain themselves. They may choke off their own energy, as Hurricane Milton did when forming a new eye wall. I noticed you just co-authored a new paper on eyewalls this year. Your thoughts on the limits to storm organization.
What we see is when we look at the distribution, the statistical distribution of storm intensity, say, as measured by their lifetime peak winds for each storm, what was the strongest wind recorded while it was alive. If we look at those statistics and we normalize them by this theoretical upper bound, we get the same distribution everywhere. And so I think it's a pretty strong hypothesis to say that that distribution won't change. And if that's true, the rising cap of the storm intensity will lift all boats. Even the very weak hurricanes will be a little bit stronger. Whether the whole frequency of storms goes up or down is not known to science at this point. But it's a sure bet that I don't think there's any physics that will stop us seeing storms that beat the current record intensity.
I have been telling listeners we still do not know why hurricanes actually spin up. Even when seas are record hot and conditions are ripe, hurricanes may not appear, as happened in August this year for a while. You've been working on this for years again. Do you know why hurricanes form?
Well, not as well as we would like, to be honest. What we do know for sure is that you have to have a very humid atmosphere, not just near the sea surface, where it's always humid in the tropics, but all the way up to 10 or 12 miles. You have to have a humid column. And if you don't have that, if you can't create that, then hurricanes can't form. And we actually think we understand that part of it pretty well. What we understand less well is how you create such columns and how that might vary with the climate state. So I haven't looked at this, have time to look at this very closely, but we have this lull in what should have been the peak of the hurricane season this year, for example, in the early part of September, where we should have had a lot and we didn't have anything. And my suspicion is that the atmosphere, for whatever reason, was particularly dry then. Now, I don't know that. I could be proved wrong. Even if that turns out to be the case, we have to understand why it suddenly dried out. What was it responding to? So we have a ways to go, but I think science is making progress toward this, and we're increasingly able to even predict with models, at least, where storms might form in the next couple of days.
In 2020, you co-authored an expert reassessment of projected hurricane response to anthropogenic warming. What is generally expected of storms in a human-induced 2-degree hotter world, and what is still in debate or unknown?
Okay, so going from the most confident to the least confident, we're all confident that a given hurricane, given that you're having a hurricane, will produce a lot more rain. The physics behind that is really, really simple. Basically, when it's hotter, the atmosphere can hold more water vapor, and therefore there's more water vapor to precipitate. It's not much more complicated than that. We think that it might even be a little bit worse than that because the storms are also stronger, and all other things being equal, a stronger storm will produce more rain. The next thing we're most confident of is what we have just been talking about, that the intensity of hurricanes should increase. We're certainly beginning to see that in satellite-based observations of storm intensity. Where we have very little confidence is whether the total number of storms, like in the Atlantic basin or anywhere else, or the total number of storms around the world, whether that will go up or down or stay the same. We just don't know. There are factors pulling storms in opposite directions that way. We kind of know what those factors are, but we don't know how they balance. We don't know which ones will win yet, so we still have to work on that.
We study the effect of climate on tropical cyclones. What about the reverse, the impact of giant storms on natural systems and warming? Could there be a feedback?
Yeah, this is a fascinating question. Certainly it's fascinated me and some of my colleagues for years. Are these just, you know, flukes that really don't matter to the climate system? Or are they an integral part of the climate system and there is a feedback? There are two plausible ways that hurricanes can feed back on the climate. First of all, they're great big dryers of the atmosphere. By precipitating so much water out, well, most of that water comes from the atmosphere, hurricanes dry out the atmosphere. And that's really demonstrably the case. And that changes things. When you have a drier atmosphere, basically you're taking a greenhouse gas, water vapor, out. So you're opening up a window for heat to escape from the surface of the Earth into space. So from that point of view, they could be a cooling effect on the climate and try to sort of damp down changes in the climate, such as the changes we're bringing about by putting greenhouse gases in. That happens is almost undoubtedly the case. Whether it's important enough to be noticeable or to have a really big effect, that we don't really understand yet. The other way they could potentially modify the system is through the ocean in several ways, both biogeochemically and physically. Physically, they churn cold water to the surface, and that's sort of a cooling effect in the tropics. But they leave behind these cold water wakes, and those gradually recover, but they recover by robbing, well, the atmosphere of heat that it would otherwise receive. You're taking heat out of the atmosphere and putting it in the ocean, and the ocean has to do something with it. And it does something by creating ocean currents that transport that heat to other places. That turns out to be not such a small effect, and it might serve to change, not so much to mitigate climate change, as to affect its regionality, where it will warm more and where it will warm less, for example. So those are the two big ones. And I should mention on the ocean side, too, there's the biogeochemistry. When it turns up all the cold water, that cold water is rich in nutrients, and you're suddenly exposing it to sunlight, and there are these big phytoplankton blooms, which you can see from satellite. And they change the biology of the ocean in ways that I think we're only beginning to understand.
There's a media storm about Milton because it struck the United States, really. And one of your early fact sheets said less than 15% of tropical cyclones rise in the Atlantic. The Pacific is much busier, and unknown to many people, massive storms brought death and wreckage to the Philippines and China in recent years. Can you tell us about one or two of those monsters in the Pacific?
Well, yes, there's the Pacific, and I would add the Indian Ocean and the Southern Hemisphere to that. But, for example, Typhoon Haiyan, which struck the Philippines not much more than 10 years ago, was a horrific event. It was probably the most intense typhoon we've seen in the record books in that part of the world. Even though the Philippines experiences Cat 5 typhoons very frequently and is quite well prepared, nobody could have been prepared for that storm. It was really horrific, the amount of damage it did. And as you suggested, we don't in the United States pay as much attention to overseas disasters as our own, which is natural, but we have to remember that they still occur.
What are you working on these days?
Well, I'm working on how we can use our increasing understanding of the physics of hurricanes to lessen the risk that they pose to society. We're trying to help insurance companies, reinsurance companies, cities and towns deal with the risk. Well, I mean, most importantly, to mitigate it, but our particular angles, how do you actually avoid some of the risk? For example, by changing policies in such a way as to encourage people to migrate from risky to safer places, where, in fact, what's happening is exactly the opposite. And this is all policy-driven. We're inadvertently subsidizing people to move to risky places for hurricanes and other risks, when we should be subsidizing them to move the other direction. So I'm trying to change that at the moment. It's a big, big thing to chew on, but there you go.
A quick question as we wrap up. We're obviously in a dire climate emergency. Have you considered wrapping up your research to focus even more on climate education and activism?
Well, research is what sort of keeps me going personally. Without doing it, it's very important to me on a personal level. But I am trying to devote more attention to education and to these programs to help society deal with hurricane risks in a more effective way.
We've been speaking with one of the world's great hurricane experts, Kerry Emanuel. He is Professor Emeritus of Atmospheric Science at MIT. You can find links to the science we just discussed in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Kerry, thank you for helping our listeners.
My pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. That was climate scientist and hurricane specialist Dr. Kerry Emanuel of MIT. You can listen to the whole interview with a link in my blog at ecoshock.org.
Please, please support your local radio station with a good donation. You know print media is floundering. TV has totally sold out to the big corporate machine and they're losing viewers. Nonprofit radio is one of the last stands of advertising free speech. I count on you to put your money where your ears are by supporting your nonprofit radio station.
Maybe James Hansen was right when he forecast storms of my grandchildren. The former NASA lead scientist expressly covered super powerful storms in the Caribbean in ages past. Far stronger than anything seen today, ancient hurricanes drove boulders bigger than pickup trucks inland way beyond the coast. Hansen expects ahistoric storms as the climate shifts. Extreme heat is dire, it's deadly. But super hurricanes or typhoons, they seem cataclysmic when they strike at full force. Melissa is just the beginning. Meanwhile, we do the best we can in between. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and spending time to care about our world.
You've done.